with other colleagues and other students at the University of Georgia. It's part of the Health Promotion Department and Behavior. I have no disclosures. So some background about the issue of sexual consent. And my approach about sexual consent is mostly in a college setting with college women and college men. We know that from Bureau of Justice Statistics that 1 in 4 women will experience some kind of sexual assault or rape during her academic or college career, and that about 48% or nearly half of those women who were sexually assaulted do not consider what happened to them to be rape or sexual assault. We also know that motivations about sexual decision making tend to differ between men and women, and that also women feel more social pressure to engage in sexual activities when they're really not that interested when compared to men. So what is consent? This is actually a really hard thing for me to find. In researching online and in research articles about what sexual consent is, there's really no definite definition. I was really surprised to find that. The University of Georgia University Health Center, we do have a consent and sexy campaign, as a lot of other universities around the nation do. And how we define consent is being a sober process. It has to be voluntary, has to be verbal, must be enthusiastic. So if someone's not really interested, that's not considered consent, even if they say yes. And it's a non-coerced process. It also tends to be this socially constructed phenomenon. You ask a bunch of different people about what sexual consent is, they all say something different. Is it a mental act or a physical act? If someone mentally consents to engage in sexual activity but they don't say it or don't show it, are they really giving consent? Or if they don't mentally consent but they're physically showing that they're interested in sex, is that really consent also? In some qualitative work that I've done in the past, that there were several women who stated that they didn't verbally say that they were interested, but they felt like, you know, they'd gotten this far, they really need to, you know, carry out the process. They really need to have sex with this partner, even though they really didn't want to. And so they showed their partner they were consenting by their physical actions. Was that really consent? So, and there are also some disagreements about whether consent must be verbal. There's no legal statement that says it has to be verbal, and Antioch College, who got together some faculty, staff, and students to decide to really state what consent must look like, they do say it must be verbal, and that's something that UGA says, and several other universities also state that it must be this verbal communication. But some colleges say that it doesn't have to be verbal. So there are a lot of disagreements about what it is and what it isn't, and also you'll see that these are not really held to by law either. We know more about what is not consent than we know about what is consent. And what we know about is that it's not consent is dictated by laws, state laws. And what I've put together here is kind of a conglomerate of what other states have provided. They all differ a little bit. Most of them do have these 4 points here that if someone's under the age of, or under a certain age, they cannot legally give consent, even if they verbally say, yes, I want to consent. They're under the age of 16 for most states, 17 for some states. They cannot legally give consent. I'll talk about these a little bit more on the next slide. But also, there are some states that also say that current or previous relationships shall not be sufficient to constitute consent, which is important because then that brings in that relationship or marital component, where if someone is in a marital relationship, they can still be sexually assaulted. And while we may know that, in a state, in a court of law, sometimes that doesn't work out. You know, sometimes someone may actually be sexually assaulted, but they can't charge their husband or their partner for it. So here's a little bit more information about what those 4 items mean, what it means to be mentally disabled, incapacitated, physically helpless, and under the age of consent. A lot of the work that I do, I've previously worked in alcohol and drug prevention in the university setting, and now I'm working in relationship and sexual violence prevention. My PhD focus is in sexual consent and sexual communication. So these things go together a lot. As you can imagine, sex and alcohol come up a lot in a college setting. And so there's a lot of questions about whether or not someone can physically or can give consent if they're under the influence of alcohol. And what I found that the states are saying is that if someone is physically helpless, they're unconscious, whether from alcohol or drugs or any other reason, they can't give consent. And that's also what a lot of universities are saying, is that if, as long as someone is not unconscious, that they can consent. But then you look at this mentally incapacitated statement here, and that if someone is incapacitated in a way that, from alcohol or drugs, in a way that prevents them from making a decision the same way they would if they were sober, that also means that they cannot give consent. And so what we say at the University of Georgia is that even if someone has had a little bit of alcohol or drugs, even if they're not passed out, they can't legally consent. And the reason for that is even if someone doesn't look like they are physically impaired by alcohol, they actually are mentally impaired at a very early stage in alcohol or drug use. Even after a drink or two, someone may make a different decision about alcohol or make a different decision about engaging in sex, whether it's who they engage in sex with or what kind of sexual activity they engage in. That can differ even after a drink or two. But sex and alcohol is kind of a totally different aspect here. So if we look back at what the state says, and then what a lot of colleges are saying is consent, what we're arguing is that true consent actually includes all of these things. Yes, it has to be sober. We know that that's what the law says. It has to also be verbal. It has to be a communication. It has to be a process. If someone gives consent to kiss someone else, it doesn't make them have consent to go farther. They need to make sure that they're getting consent every step of the way. And a lot of colleges have done a really great job of stating this through the University Health Center or other women's centers on campus about what consent should be and is. But in a court of law, these don't necessarily hold up. Some other complications with consent, as I said, with drugs and alcohol, a lot of people argue that someone can still give consent even after they've been drinking. And it's a really tricky situation. Most of the sexual assaults that we see at the University Health Center did have alcohol involved. They weren't even passed out. But does that mean that if they had alcohol and they weren't passed out, they couldn't consent or they could consent? So it's really tricky. There's also gender and cultural norms that affect communication about sex. A lot of times, especially our youth today, are not really talking or communicating about sex. They feel it's awkward. Having that conversation and verbally saying, I want to have sex, or I want to do this, or I want to do that, they don't feel comfortable doing it. They lack the communication skills to be able to do that. Also, there's a lack of clear definition of consent by law. Aside from those four things, if someone isn't consenting, but they don't meet those four criteria, or they do meet those four criteria, that's considered consent. They're consenting, even if they don't really want to be doing it. And that's kind of what we're arguing here. The study that we are looking at here is how interest and coercion can influence decision-making and whether or not that constitutes consent. So if someone is coerced or they're not interested in having sex, but then someone forces them to have it, is that really consent if they verbally say it? We looked at a sample of 322 college students at the University of Georgia, and we used a survey that Dr. Jessica Mollenberg has been providing or has been conducting since 2008. And in 2012, I helped construct some questions specifically about sexual consent to get some information about what's happening with our students. So we used five survey questions from that larger survey. The majority of our respondents were female, majority were also white. There were also undergraduate college students, so between the ages of 18 and 22 approximately. So the first question of that cluster of five questions is, have you ever had sexual contact when you did not want to? And when we break that down by gender, you can see that this is statistically significant that yes, more women, statistically significantly more women, did have sex when they didn't want to compared to men. We're looking at, has anyone persuaded you to have sexual contact? And there doesn't seem to be much of a difference here between men and women when they get to the point of being asked whether they're persuaded. Have you ever persuaded someone to have sexual contact with you? Break it down. Now, here we also see something that is significant. So before we saw that a lot of women were consenting or engaging in sexual activity when they didn't want to. Now we see that more men, significantly more men, are admitting to persuading a woman to have sex with them or a partner to have sex with them. And then, did you ever have sexual contact when you did not consent? This would kind of explicitly be about rape or sexual assault. And when it came to the questions about explicit rape or sexual assault, people were saying, no, that didn't happen to me, or I didn't do that. But when you look at the more, some of the more delicate issues, it looks like it maybe did happen. Have you ever been forced to have sexual contact? And again, very explicitly stated, we don't really see much of a difference here, or many people reporting that either. The reason that this is important is because of the Title IX and Clery Act and also the Campus Save Act. Does anyone know about Clery and Title IX? So Title IX is something that was implemented that for all universities that are federally funded, they have to report the number of sexual assaults that happen on campus. And we all have a Title IX coordinator that makes sure that all of these things are reported to the state. And the Clery Act is part of that. There's also part of that that requires the university to educate its students and do something to prevent these things from happening, sexual assault from happening. Campus Save Act is part of the Violence Against Women Act that passed, I think, this year, last year. Anyway, it's going to go into effect next year, and it'll affect the students that are matriculating about fall 2014. This is protecting our students even further. It's not just about sexual assault now. It's also going to include stalking must be reported. Intimate partner violence must also be reported as well. And it also goes further to state that all universities must do their part to educate what consent is, educate the population about sexual consent, and then also do their part in preventing sexual violence or any intimate partner violence from happening on campus. So we're doing that. We're educating our students, as a lot of other universities are doing, as I said, providing what is consent, and we're saying it's verbal, it's sober, it's voluntary, it's a process. But that's not what the law is saying. There's also a lot of, social norm messaging could happen on campuses where we're really expecting people to understand what consent is and to teach men, even in specific programming, focusing towards college men about what it means to obtain consent. Because anytime we do a sexual assault program or relationship and sexual violence prevention program, we ultimately will get the questions from men, well, what if both people are drunk? Or what if she doesn't say it? Because we never have that conversation. There's this sort of social idea among people that as long as they don't talk about it, but they show in other ways that somehow it's consent. But is that really consent? And we need to do our part in making sure that students know what consent is and that they're following that process. So focusing more on men may be more helpful. It tends to be when we do those programs, that people can come in and see voluntarily, it tends to be women that show up, We really need to get to men to show them what consent means and what they need to do to get consent and give consent. And also policy level change. I mean, we know what universities are putting out there in terms of what's considered sexual consent, sober, voluntary process, enthusiastic, but that's not what the law is going to hold them accountable for. So these things really need to work together. There's nothing we can do to hold students accountable if they didn't get a verbal consent, because that's not what the law is going to hold them accountable for. So we know that women are significantly more likely than men to report engaging in sexual activities when they don't want to. We know that from the justice statistics and also what we saw here from this data. We also know that men are significantly more likely to persuade a partner to have sex with them than a woman would. And then we also have these inconsistent messages between laws and college policies that are sending mixed signals about what someone can be held accountable for and what someone's required to do in an actual sexual situation. That's it. So here is my contact information. If you have any questions about what we're doing at the University of Georgia or how things are working currently with Title IX, Clery Act, or SAVE Act, I have some business cards as well. And I know we'll do questions at the end. So thank you all very much.